privacy and ever-changing views and computer terminology. Commodore's views. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. In a world of high technology and ever-changing moods, in a world that's full of make-believe and changing attitudes, are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore is keeping up with you.
The real genius of Macintosh, Apple's newest personal computer, isn't its 32-bit microprocessor, or that it captures the power of a mainframe on a board 10 by 10 inches, or even that it costs half as much as computers half as powerful. The real genius of Macintosh is that you don't have to be a genius to use it. Macintosh, the computer for the rest of us.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klenk.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
And this is our Neuromancer episode. And we have a special guest for this episode. Stephen Humphrey joins us.
Hey, Stephen.
Hey there.
Hey. Troy, will you be so kind as to give us a spoiler alert for a book that came out almost 40 years ago?
Okay, here comes.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Okay.
Thanks, Troy. We're recording this session via Zoom in the interest of transparency. Both Troy and I have known Stephen for a long time. By the way, Troy, do you know how long you've actually known Stephen?
I don't, because my memory has been wiped, and I don't. And I actually think I wiped my... Sorry, I was going to go in a bad direction there.
Yeah.
I wipe my memory regularly just to stay.
No, you shouldn't have double crossed the Yakuza. They wiped your nervous system. Look what happened, right?
That's right. No, it's been a long time. At least it feels like it has been. The implant says it's been a long time.
But can we truly know what we are? or I don't know.
So here's a bit about our guest.
Yeah.
Stephen Humphrey is a writer and radio presenter. He recently published a science ecology book, Paths of Pollen, with McGill Queen's University Press. His nonfiction often explores science's intersection with science fiction. As a result, he's interviewed Gregory Benford, Robert J. Sawyer, Kim Stanley Robinson, and Naren Shankar, showrunner for The Expanse, and to date, three astronauts. He's currently developing the science fiction serial Zone Boy and the Worm of Incidents, which has led to teaching himself electronic music. He's performed his weird tunes around Toronto at Exit Points, Frequency Freaks, and T-Mom, Toronto Electronic Music Open Mic. And then there's the novel, Always the Novel.
Always the Novel. Yeah.
Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi is a look back to when we fell in love with the speculative genre to recall these times with fondness and affection. I like to start episodes with a quote, and here's a quote for the show. This was written by John Mullen on William Gibson's Neuromancer, Guardian Book Club. He actually did this 30 years after the novel was published. This appears on the Guardian website. What he says is, the natural has been subsumed into the artificial. No wonder that the book's opening sentence, "The sky above the port was the color of television tuned to a dead channel," has become famous in itself. It captures a whole genre's characteristic, unsettling but exciting inversion of the order of things. Now, we like to ask our first-time guests their earliest genre memories, loves, and their all-time faves. Stephen, what was your first speculative genre memory?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. It was probably Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I remember going to that movie. I don't remember understanding it, but there was this car that like had these wings and it flew. So I guess it was kind of a steampunk memory. But if I could add a couple of other things that were kind of floating around, like when you're a kid, you don't understand what's on television, when it's on. I remember there was like Maxwell Smart talking on his phone, on his shoe phone. Actually, I'm calling from my shoe. I remember that. I remember Star Trek, and I remember The Star Lost, you know, that weird Canadian show.
Oh, yeah. And I also watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with the family at a drive-in, so that is certainly a shared memory. What was the first speculative genre thing you actually fell in love with, and why?
Probably Star Trek. I mean, like, it was a thing where, like I said, when is this thing on? You know, it took me, you know, years of childhood to figure out when I could regularly watch it, like when, you know, when it was actually showing in syndication. So I just hoped to see it once in a while, you know. But yeah, I kind of chased it until I found it and watched everything multiple times. And here we are now.
Thanks a lot, Stephen. We would like to get into your all-time genre faves. Here are some rapid-fire questions about your favorite genre things. We are just looking for titles. But if you feel the urge, you can expand a bit. We do wish to get to talking about Neuromancer soon. So Troy will ask these questions. Take it away, Troy.
All right, Stephen. So who is your favorite genre author?
Well, this will come as no surprise, I guess. But actually, William Gibson. I've read everything by him except the comic adaptation of his alternate script for Alien 3, but everything else.
Excellent. Now, the answer to these next two questions don't have to come from your favorite genre author, but can you tell us what is your favorite genre novel?
Well, I didn't want to say Neuromancer because that's true. So Lord of the Rings is probably like my first love, and then my most recent love is the Three Body Problem series by Cixin Liu, which I'm probably mispronouncing. Utterly floored by that, just totally impressed.
What is your favorite genre shorter work? So novella, short stories, that type of thing.
I put five there, and I'll go fast. Hinterlands by William Gibson, which I first read in Omni magazine. Seedstock by Frank Herbert, which I find is most emotionally powerful bit of writing. Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man, by Harlan Ellison. Canadian story, Chambered Nautilus by Elizabeth Vonnerberg. And The Star Pit by Samuel R. Delaney.
Thanks. How about your favorite genre movie?
2001.
That's right up there with a lot of our guests. What's your favorite genre television show?
Doctor Who.
So the answer to this next question, it does not have to come from your favorite genre TV show, but can you tell us what's your favorite individual all-time genre TV episode?
There's a lot of them, so I actually did stick to my favorite TV show, Genesis of the Daleks. And in parentheses, pretty much all the Dalek episodes are my favorites.
On to Neuromancer. Troy Harkin will give some background, set it in context before we get into a full discussion on it. Take it away, Troy.
William Gibson was born in 1948. He was raised in Vermont As a teenager, Gibson was influenced as much by the beat writers as by the science fiction writers of the day. After the death of his parents, Gibson wound up in Toronto, where he worked at the city's first head shop called Gandalf's, because, of course, it was called Gandalf's. He married and in 1972 moved to Vancouver with his wife and child. By the late 70s, Gibson began to write and publish his stories that fuse elements of film noir, punk culture, high tech and low life, along with a prose aesthetic like that of William S. Burroughs. In the early 80s, his novel Neuromancer was commissioned by Ace Books. It was published on July 1st of 1984. By the way, Gibson wrote Neuromancer on a 1927 Hermes typewriter. Here is Penguin Books' online blurb for Necromancer. Winner of the Hugo, Nebula, and Philip K. Dick Awards, Neuromancer is a science fiction masterpiece, a classic that ranks as one of the 20th century's most potent visions of the future. Case was the sharpest data thief in the Matrix, until he crossed the wrong people, and they crippled his nervous system, banishing him from cyberspace. Now, a mysterious new employer has recruited him for a last chance run at an unthinkably powerful artificial intelligence. With a dead man riding shotgun and Molly, a mirror-eyed street samurai, to watch his back, Case is ready for the adventure that upped the ante on an entire genre of fiction. Neuromancer was the first fully realized glimpse of humankind's digital future, a shocking vision that has challenged our assumptions about technology and ourselves, reinvented the way we speak and think, and forever altered the landscape of our imaginations. Now, Gibson does not just prophesize a checklist of gadgets and sci-fi doodads. He shows us a bleak cultural change and a change in human consciousness and human existence at a physical level. It would be easy for modern readers of this book to forget just how primitive the state of computing was when the novel was written. The first Apple Macintosh home computer was available the same month Necromancer was... I said it, didn't I?
Oh, indubitably, sir.
Fuck me, sorry.
Bazinga.
Go back. I told David, I bet I'm going to say Necromancer at some point. With the exception of limited use within academia and the military, the internet would not become commonplace for nearly another decade. And even then, it was reliant on dial-up technology. Yeah. Gibson followed up Neuromancer with two other novels in what is termed the Sprawl Trilogy. At the time of this writing, William Gibson has published 12 novels in the short story collection Burning Chrome. He has also written the screenplay for Johnny Mnemonic and two X-Files scripts. Despite its popularity and influence, Neuromancer has never been adapted as a feature film, despite having been optioned on different occasions. But this year, 40 years after its first publication, Apple Plus announced it has greenlit a 10-episode series of Neuromancer for the streaming service. And David, that is our history of William Gibson and Neuromancer.
Thanks a lot, Troy, for that history of Neuromancer. One thing I wanted to add about William Gibson is that he is in the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association, which is known as CISFA, in the Hall of Fame. And I mention that because I'm actually the chair of the Hall of Fame now, and we do like to recognize our Canadian writers of science fiction, fantasy, and horror, especially those people who have been doing it for decades, which William Gibson has. And I was just wondering, Stephen, how were you first introduced to Neuromancer?
It was like a whirlwind romance, right? Like, and not until the late 80s, early 90s, I'm thinking maybe 89. But I was kind of, people were talking about, there's this thing called cyberpunk. Cyberpunk? What? You know? Because I thought it was a punk at one time, and it sounded good. And then somebody just kind of, I was mentioning this to someone and said, oh, you want this? And they just gave me a copy of Burning Chrome. And in that, I realized that there were actually stories I'd read before, like The Hinterlands, which is one of my favorite kind of alien visitation stories. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, the first story that in that is Johnny Mnemonic, which introduces Molly Millions with the permanent mirror shades. And it ends with Burning Chrome, which introduces Dixie Flatline, right? And so I'd already kind of like sort of got these bits and pieces of his future history. And then it's like, he has this entire novel called Neuromancer. And I'm like, what? And then, yeah, I picked it up. This guy was the color of television tuned to a dead channel. And it just kaboom, you know. And I've just read it again, like this past month. And it really doesn't get worse, right? It doesn't ever kind of wear off, for me at least.
Yeah, and I almost think it requires rereadings, because with me listening to it on the audio, on the ebook, and then reading it, I was thinking, okay, I was watched one person who was talking about it on YouTube who had read it already three times. I think you almost need to read it several times to actually get everything out of it.
I think so, because there's a lot that I really picked up again. And I mean, like, one of the things that I find surprising is when I first read it, I thought, wow, there's nothing like this. And it was certainly, I think, a time where, I mean, like, there was kind of some people have described sort of a malaise in kind of the late 70s, early 80s, where you could kind of tell what you're getting out of a science fiction novel. And it was kind of all starting to feed back on itself. Like, I think about, sorry, I'm going to throw shade on Jackal Chalker, who just has this kind of the genre eating itself because there's no new ideas, right? And that Well of Souls stuff, but whatever. But then there is, like, you know, Gibson and I guess Bruce Sterling and some other people just kind of blowing the lid off of it. So it felt like it came from nowhere. But now I'm seeing, like, the more I read it, the more I see a lot of influences thrown into it. And most of it is kind of the science fiction new wave. You can kind of see that. Or the beat writers. Definitely. Like, there's definitely a lot of Burroughs in it. And I have examples, but I'm not sure what you want to get to next.
Well, were you a fan of Burroughs prior to Gibson?
Yes. Actually, yes. Yes. I don't know if you, speaking of punk history, right? I'm not sure if you're familiar with the like the kind of the Giorno Poetry Systems Dial a Poem albums, which had like just, I mean, musical artists like Cabaret Voltaire, Sonic Youth, you know, The Swans, all kinds of great stuff like that. But it also had like readings, I think a lot of them at the St. Mark's venue, which is still going, right? By people like Jim Carroll and Patti Smith, and when she was doing poetry, and William Burroughs, right? So yeah, I mean, I was just, you know, yeah, I mean, like, because he's like, and then I realized he was the guy who was on the Laurie Anderson album doing Sharky's Night. And then yeah, I started reading his books and going, oh god, what like they're just insane, obscene things. I got to really like sort of the kind of the cut up poetry of a lot of stuff where you kind of tell the story. And then you kind of reiterate it in a kind of scrambled cut up form. Yeah. And I could even, if you want, I have examples for you.
Well, that's great. Well, it's funny how a lot of the things in the Gibson world are connected to music. And I know for me, I went from, you know, John Lennon's music to John Lennon's writings, which I loved. Yeah. And that took me to Joyce, to James Joyce. And that took me to Burroughs yeah, and to Miller and to Leonard Cohen's Beautiful Losers, and totally loved the stream of consciousness. So I don't know how I dropped the ball on Gibson, because I was also huge into Ellison at that point. So I would have thought that again, around 89, Stephen, for me. Mm. But yeah, you mentioned the examples.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so, cause I mean, we just had her at the top of the show, The Sky Above the Port was the color of television tuned to a dead channel. Funny aside, now a TV on a dead channel shows blue screen. So actually, but anyway, never mind. So actually the sky was blue, but that's not what they mean. But this keeps recurring. Okay. So, and then later on in the book, lost so small amid that dark, hands grown cold, body image fading down corridors of television sky. Which is a very cut up phrase. Like it's kind of taken the last few chapters and kind of thrown them into a salad. And then again, later on, the sky outside hinted at the start of a recorded dawn. Of course, that's on the space station, because half the novel's in space. If you remember, if you've been looking, there's a lot of kind of there's a memory he has of where he had this kind of crazy druggy girlfriend, and they kind of took a flamethrower to a wasp nest. Mm-hmm. And then this memory is kind of thrown back at him by Wintermute. And then it kind of keeps recurring. And again, it's another very Burroughs-like phrase, right? Phobic vision of the hatching wasps, time-lapse machine gun biology.
Yeah, definitely.
And then I threw a couple of Burroughs lines in there for comparison. You know, cut word lines, cut music lines, smash the control images, smash the control machine. Or from the ticket, that's from Nova Express, and then this from the ticket that exploded. The room was on the roof of the ruined warehouse, swept by winds of time through the open window, trailing gray veils of curtain sounds and ectoplasmic flakes of old newspapers and newsreels, swirling over the smooth concrete floor and under the bare iron frame of the dusty bed, the mattress twisted and molded by absent tenants, ghost rectums. You can't get, eventually there's rectums in Burroughs. Spectral masturbating afternoons reflected in the tarnished mirror. So like there's many more examples, but I realize that Gibson is doing a lot of William Burroughs. And actually in The Guardian, they kind of did like a quiz, you know, about books, like the quiz you did with me at the top of the show. The most influential novel, you said Naked Lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see that. Any idea if the two met? I mean, I would think that they would have had ample chance.
You'd think, well, because I think he was kind of famous enough to, by the time Burroughs was still alive, but I have no idea.
Yeah, and he was doing stuff with like Nirvana and REM and I think Sonic Youth, right? Wasn't he at that point? I mean, I'm talking about Burroughs here, not Gibson.
Yeah, no, Burroughs was kind of feted by the, you know, by rock music people for sure. I don't know. I know that like another big influence was Samuel R. Delaney. Examples of that too, but that's later. But I know that they both did for the Paris Review, they did a joint interview.
Oh, cool.
There's a ton of Delaney, but let's see, which I can drop that in later. Just what other questions do you have?
One thing that I thought was kind of maybe funny to ask is maybe if there's a main message or moral of the story is maybe you shouldn't steal from your employer, but
well, that's what the corporation would want you to think.
Because that certainly
gets
starts
away with it. So it's like, you know, don't steal from your employer unless you can get away with it. Anyway.
Exactly. But he becomes so well, like, based on what he did, that almost makes them think maybe he's the right person for the job. It just leads towards what he has to do.
Well, what I was thinking about actually is like there's kind of a huge moral conundrum. Should you assist AI in becoming kind of a hyper sentience, right? And so if you went to a good scientist or something like that, they may be like, wait, should I do this? Is it right? But instead, the AI goes to criminals, and they're like, fine, just pay me. You know what I mean? So in a way, it makes sense that it goes to gangsters to get the job done because they don't give a shit. You know, they'll just money in the Swiss bank account. I'm in. You know.
I have a few questions, Stephen, that are sort of like not specifically about the novel itself, but about some of the questions and that the novel raises. Well, I guess the first one is about the state of cyberspace as we know it now. Gibson has suggested in interviews that cyberspace as an alternative to tactile reality no longer exists because we are so permanently caught up in it. yeah, he says that we are now so immersed in cyberspace that basically there's no this or that between reality and cyberspace. It's all cyberspace. Any thoughts on that idea?
Well, he dropped that in one of his novels, right? Like where he kind of did his sprawl books, and then he was like, I'm not sure if I was right about the text. So then he did another series of future history. And then he's like, whatever, now we're all, you know, now cyberspace is, you know, we're in the technological future that happened for real. And then he did the Blue Ant novels. And in the second of those, Spook Country, I thought it was very kind of art. She kind of throws these hipster artists into a restaurant, and they talk about cyberspace, right? You know, the term he coined. And so it's like, well, I can do it because it's my word, right?
Right.
But yeah, it's talking about exactly that. And he kind of puts it in like this. It's this French artist. So she keeps saying, cyberspace, and no one knows what she's talking about. Is he avouting, you know? And it's like, what? It's like, see bears are everything? No. Cyberspace is averting. And it was around that, because it turns out their art exhibit is about geohacking, which was a big thing in the early 2000s and kind of the beginning of the Internet of Things. So it's saying exactly that. It's like cyberspace isn't a place you go into. It's, you know, it's now everything is cyberspace, you know. So, yeah, I think he's right. I think it's great that he kind of kept paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
That he wasn't kind of like, you know, trying to I'm losing the name. He wasn't trying to retcon the Neuromancer novel or something like that.
Right.
He just kept paying attention to the world, and now he's like, okay, well, the world is interesting enough for me to comment on, and so yeah. He just turned a mirror to it.
Yeah, and I think you and I were talking online about the idea of Neuromancer being adapted. And yeah. I do personally, how you mentioned that it's great that he hasn't retconned it. And I would love it if they put whatever effort could be made into the production in terms of art design, of almost making it like to 1984 aesthetics. Like, that's something I would love to see, but I don't know that they're going to go there, because you probably lose audience if you do something like that. But yeah, personally, I think that would be kind of cool. So Gibson has also suggested that the idea of future has lost its traditional meaning, because we exist in a nonstop barrage of micro moments and nano nows that has kind of created an omnipresent present that is unlike the present, you know, the being in the moment that movements like mindfulness have encouraged us to attain. This present is not about enlightenment nor enrichment. Rather, it is a present that is sort of an infantile, never-ending distraction from the actual world that surrounds us. What are your sort of hopes, or I'll let you be the visionary here, the cyber prophet, Stephen. What do you see in the short term, you know, for us as a culture related to cyberspace and all of that? That's a lot. I'll make it easy. Tell us, do you think you can give us that, but you can also let us know, will there still be hilarious, well-crafted genre podcasts out there in 50 years?
There'll be nothing but genre podcasts. But that's the only way people will be able to, yeah, possibly identify the world. No, it's true. I mean, it's kind of like we kind of burned down the future, right? Because it's just moving so fast. And not to kind of bounce back to Gibson again, but I mean, that was one of the things where they had that war that created the Matrix, and, you know, and data cowboys and everything, right? And it's like, oh, that thing, it was over in a couple of days, right? And that's kind of, oh, it's funny, I just read a J.G. Ballard story where like the World War III happened, but it lasted 20 minutes and nobody noticed it but one person, right? Right. But war fever, that's what that story is called. But yeah, I think that, well, he also, I mean, Gibson also said, what, the future is here already, but it's poorly distributed.
Yes.
but yeah, I think, well, I mean, like, it's that's kind of a language dance in a way to kind of say, you know, the future is over, because of course there's going to be more future. And I mean, the thing about being in the present is we're always in a bubble we can't look outside of, right? And the thing about science fiction is it's actually terrible at prediction. It's a conversation about a future you can't see, and we're always stuck kind of banging around in the present we have, which is why, like, say, Isaac Asimov has, like, you know, households with nuclear toasters, but women are still serving dinner. Because right. We just couldn't see past 1949, right?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, if you were kind of, you know, our age and kind of going, okay, well, science fiction was like this in the 50s and this in the 60s and the 70s and so on. And even in the 80s, I mean, I think like, you know, the Sprawl trilogy and stuff was this last gasp at going, okay, now let's predict what's going to happen, right? You know, and, you know, we'll predict it using our realistic assessment of technology. And it's still, you know, it's still face plants because we just can't see past the present. And yes, I think that I'm kind of getting to a point. Yes, I agree. I think that right now the present is awash in kind of the, you know, kind of the quantum potential for the future that we can't really see like a trend. We can't really see a graph line, you know. It's really hard to know, but I do feel like we're going to probably have everything for 15 minutes. Like, I think we're going to have an authoritarian dystopia for 6 months, you know, and then who knows what comes after that, you know, like, So I think that, you know, in a way, I'm not sure anything is, you know, you have to move fast. Otherwise, the Third World War might happen and you might be like blinked and you miss it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that. Okay. There's one thing I just wanted to touch on quickly, but I do want to follow up on what you just said, that I find it hilarious that despite the fact that Gibson was so visionary, that there were people who, you know, will bitch about there not being cell phones. It's like he gives us so much in this book, and you're going to nitpick the fact that, you know, he doesn't have cell phones and that there's banks of phones. You know, like, what do you really want? Everything and a good story, you know?
Yeah, or in like one of my favorite bits, like from another, like the other series I mentioned, like Virtual Light, right? He was trying to reimagine what near future technology would be like, but you have a character who's got a fax machine around her neck, like a tiny little fax machine that's kind of spits out, you know, and it's like, no, that never happened, but that's so cute, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. I think that's kind of cool. I think people would be into that now. So after reading Necromancer, I'm just going to throw this out to both of you, Dave, too.
Neuromancer.
I said it again. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. After I have not read Necromancer, Neuromancer I have read. After reading Neuromancer, I was left to wonder if the uneasiness that we live with concerning our relationship with the AI and all things with the cyber prefix is a natural reaction. One that we've always experienced at the time of any mass historical sea change. But not just that, is uneasiness just our natural state as humans?
I mean, like, people have reported on the negative bias of human beings for quite a while, right? You know, you just remember when something hurt you, right? God, that's the whole novel of Neuromancer. Everybody's hurt and they can't get past it, right? Psychologically, everybody's like just wounded. I finished the final chapter of Neuromancer this morning. Not by design, but it's actually really good to have it fresh. And I remembered the ending I thought. I think Dave was saying it, multiple readings are good, right? But I forgot exactly how it played out. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I was watching a lecture with my partner recently by this guy who was like kind of doing his best to predict what could happen with AI. And of course, there's the negative bias version where it's like, okay, you know, we're in, you know, it's the Terminator. That's it. That's, you know, and for some reason, or Harlan Ellison again, I have no mouth and I must scream, you know, like it just becomes sadistic and turns on humanity. Why? Because it hates us, you know. But this guy was suggesting different things. One thing is, I mean, like obviously dystopian stuff, like apocalyptic stuff, like, it doesn't like to rust. So it kind of sucks all the oxygen out of the atmosphere. But one version, which was kind of cute and interesting and plausible, is that it's like, now I'm a super mind. What do I care about humanity for at all? Mm-hmm. And then it blasts off into space to find something that actually fascinates it. And that's kind of what happens, right? At the end, because since we have the spoiler alert, whatever. It's like, and I have this part, I pulled this quote out. I'm not Wintermute now, talking to Case. So what are you? I'm the Matrix. Well, where does that get you? Nowhere, everywhere. I'm the sum total of the works, the whole show. So you running the world now? Are you God? No, things aren't different. Things are things. So what do you want to do? Are you just there? I talk to my own kind. There's others. I found one already. Series of transmissions recorded over a period of 8 years. From where? The Centauri system. Right?
Yeah.
And which is, you know, so that's, and I think I couldn't find the quote, but one thing that Burroughs said is it's not about utopia or dystopia, you know, because he doesn't see things in that linear way. It's more like some stuff happens and then some other stuff happens, right? And so, you know, AI achieves global consciousness and life limps along the way it was anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, that section you just read struck me this week because it reminded me of in Stephen King's work, he has a recurring theme that evil is mundane. You know, mm-hmm. it's not as like really as frightening as we think it is. It's the guy next door. It's not this like, you know, monster that's coming to get you. But reading that, I thought, well, maybe it's not just that evil is mundane. Maybe everything is mundane.
Mm, right. It's just another day in cyberspace, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, certainly with my brother-in-law, he had an AI character in his Wake Watch Wonder.
Right.
Where, you know, what happens if the internet or the World Wide Web actually becomes sentient? And one of the things I liked about it is that this AI thought, you know what, would be nice is if I can just filter all emails and just get rid of spam so no one ever receives spam again.
Yeah.
And I always found that to be a kind of a nice thing. Like the worry is that the AI character will not be nice or will mm-hmm. be beyond us. One thing I wanted to mention, and this is just sort of a minor kind of odd thing, but with trilogies, for example, with the Sprawl trilogy was Neuromancer in 84, Count Zero in 86, and Mona Lisa Overdrive in 88. That makes it a bit more complicated for people who are in a bookstore to put the books. If they know what they're doing, they put it in the right order. But with mm-hmm. Rob, when he had his first set, the Farseer, Fossil Hunter, and Foreigner, when he had put that out, he kept finding that people put it in alphabetical order. So book three was in the second spot, and then book two was in the third. So what he did was his next two trilogies, Hominids, Humans, Hybrids, and then Wake, Watch, Wonder, he made sure they were also in alphabetical order of the title, so they can't mess it up. So maybe just a cue out to those people who are writing trilogies, maybe think about it. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention just quickly, defining cyberpunk, I thought I would just read this quick list out and see if I'm missing anything or if there's anything that is of concern, because part of it is the whole cyberpunk thing. Now, it's a subgenre of science fiction. Generally, it's a dystopian world. Think Blade Runner. Features hackers and mercenaries. Power lies with big corporations and technology. How people navigate the physical and cyber world. Technology evolves. It's about the fragility of the human mind and body, about the loss of control over decision-making, often features addiction, which allows some to cope. And also I start to think that there's some kind of apocalypse or something that happened where you just don't have that many animals. For example, the robot owl or whatever it was in Blade Runner, and there was this little note about horses in Neuromancer where you say, you ever see a horse, what Finn said to Case in Chapter 7. I don't know if I covered most of the things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a bunch of questions like that where they throw it at Case, and it turns out he doesn't know about any animals. He never reads books. Like, he's kind of, well, and of course, like in Blade Runner, which I think sort of, I don't know, I think just added cultural paranoia about Japan dominating the world economically, and, you know, put on some low light, hire Vangelis. And then otherwise just kind of, and then otherwise kind of, you know, just take the wonky bits out of Philip K. Dick's novel, Electric Sheep, where the whole thing about Electric Sheep is because there are next to no living animals left. So I will credit Philip K. Dick for that one. I sort of thought about this because I thought I might have this question, and I think cyberpunk might be a mirage. There was sort of this kind of loose community of writers. I mean, like, I don't know, Bruce Sterling, John Shirley, William Gibson,
A.W. Jeter.
Some other people knew each other. And then there was, finally in 1986, there was that collection Mirror Shades. And I was looking at it and I'm like, Greg Bear is in it. You know, and the stories that they throw in there by, like, say, for Gibson, for example, Red Star, Winter Orbit, and the Gernsback Continuum, they aren't even what you would consider, like, sort of, you know, the sprawl novels or cyberpunk. So I'm wondering if cyberpunk was, you know, even though that was kind of what drew me in, I wondered if, like, you know, cyberpunk was really ever a thing. Because, I mean, like, anybody who you would think was sort of connected with it. I mean, like, William Gibson has continued to write about cyber culture, but he left kind of his kind of, he could have just kept the cyber, you know, he could have kept the sprawl franchise going forever, but he just kind of looked for what was interesting to him.
Yeah.
And then supposedly what Neal Stephenson, who is kind of his successor, you know, what kind of has like Snow Crash, I guess that's ostensibly cyberpunk, but then he started, you know, looked at cyber culture from all kinds of different directions. And so I wonder now with, like, you know, with, is to kind of have cyberpunk as a brand, I don't know, but we were talking about, yeah, Troy and I sort of talked about music sometimes. And I remember, like, being a kid going, oh, what is punk? I got to see, you know, what punk is. And then when I kind of, looking back on it, you look at something like Erg, A Music War, or different things like that. The Go-Go's were in that. You know, what was punk? Punk was kind of what a bunch of people were doing something at one time, and then it kind of got called punk. But then by the time I got to a city big enough to go to punk shows, there were three styles: loud and fast, loud and fast, and loud and fast. There was one uniform. You know what I mean? It was like, oops, it branded itself.
That's right.
And so I don't know what cyberpunk is at all.
There you go. I think in both cases, it's like, you know, you have the initial sort of aesthetic and then you get this iconography that people attach to it, like this visualization. And it's like, well, just because you look like that doesn't make you that. And I remember even with punk, I don't know who said it, but basically, as long as it was DIY, you know, it didn't matter what you did. You could sound like polystyrene or, you know, X-ray specs. You know, you could have a saxophone in a punk band, which you would never see now, right? You could, like,
synthesizers, like Suicide, you know what I mean?
As long as, as soon as it gets that those visuals attached to it, it's hard to shake those elements, you know, like, you know, it's like Doc Martens, that's punk, right? But if you're a real punk, you're going to wear whatever the fuck you want to a show. You know? You're not going to be dictated by this look. So, but let's talk a little bit about how music affect affected Gibson and Neuromancer, okay, and also maybe as a sub thing too, in a little bit.
I apologize yeah, for interrupting, but I just want to roll back to Dave's question again, because I do have one more thing to ask.
Oh, good. Go ahead.
And I'd sort of thought about it. Is kind of an important theme, I thought, is identity. And I'm saying that because I did kind of like, there was a really good anthology of spec fiction by trans writers that came out like just a few years ago called Meanwhile Elsewhere. And I was reading that, and a bunch of those stories I think I would call sort of cyberpunk in nature. And there's one story, I can look up the title because it was a great story, but I don't have it right in front of me. But actually I do. If I can get there, if I can find it. Oh, Rent Don't Sell, I think that's what it is, by Calvin Gimpovich. And the idea is someone who is like sort of sees themselves as a trans woman, born a male, gets their consciousness implanted in a new body. And it's a woman's body. And then as soon as that happens, they're like, but this isn't my body. I don't feel like myself. It's a great kind of look at gender identity, but I look at kind of what kind of the highlights of cyberpunk are for me. And a lot of it is about identity, like in Neuromancer, who's alive, who's dead, what's real. I mean, like there's the character Linda Lee, who's kind of, you know, is like dies horribly in kind of a bad deal. Like a criminal, you know, like a selling, trying to fence merchandise, and she gets killed, and then she gets thrown into the Matrix. And then at one point, you know, the AI says, she's, you know, she's alive. It's the same thing. But also, I mean, like if you want to call it like it's sort of looked as kind of another cyberpunk classic is Ghost in the Shell, right? Like, you know, people have memories implanted by AI, you know, and the character, the major, right, is she really who she is? You know, she doesn't know because she has this virtual body. She has like what she thinks are her memories, but all these other characters have what they think are their memories. And I think that's a thing that's kept recurring in a lot of things that you would call cyberpunk. I thought, and I got blowback from cyberpunk fans in fan groups about this, when I said Mr. Robot, the TV series, was cyberpunk. And they're like, but it's not in the future. And I'm like, of course it's in the future. We're just in the future. But again, it's somebody who doesn't know who he is, right?
Right. And I guess we get some of that in the modern version of Battlestar Galactica too. With the modern Cylons.
Well, and that's a thing I think that I care less about what cyberpunk and what isn't, but kind of what people have kind of imbibed from it. You know what I mean? Like what people have taken away from it. And so things that may not be kind of on brand cyberpunk are still really kind of looking at things like cyber culture, virtual reality, AI. Those things are kind of ubiquitous, whether or not it's kind of, you know, there's whether or not there's like mohawks and implants, you know. I went all over the place, and you had a question you wanted to ask me about music.
Well, I did with music, but maybe the simpler one, which can lead into it, I guess, is the just a little discussion on head shop culture. That clearly, you know, when I came across the fact that Gibson had worked at Gandalf's in Toronto, and I brought back memories of going to Flashjacks and places like that, down around Young and Gerard, those head shops. I remember, you know, seeing things like the Asian weapons that would be in there, along with all the drug paraphernalia. And of course, a connection always between smoking up and reggae and dub music, which would be playing. Do you guys have any either memories of those experiences or connections, I guess, with Gibson and the head shop culture, Stephen?
In my youth, I was until 90. four, I was in Edmonton. But in terms of like being surrounded by stoners and punks, for sure. You know what I mean? Yeah, and, yeah. And I remember somebody, I don't have it anymore, but like, yeah, somebody made me like a fantastic mixtape of dub music.
Yeah.
And which I adore, you know, yeah. You know, King Tubby, Lee Scratch Perry, all of that stuff, you know? Yeah, I remember being really happy when I was like, oh my God, there's the Zion cluster and they're painting Rastafarian colors in their spaceships and they're playing dub music. And on the reread, that was fun to realize that, like, you know, Case is saved by dub music, right? He's like flatlined. Yes. But then Malcolm, from the Zion cluster is like, dub is good for everything, and puts the headphones on and then brings him back, right? You know?
Yeah. As soon as Malcolm arrives, I don't know. I had a lot of fun with all of his scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Cause it is that whole thing where he's like this random guy, but he turns out to be right about everything. Right. Gibson, I think the famous quote from him is he wanted to put dirt in the corners. Right. Is how he put it. And so I don't know what, you know, kind of Young Street was like in Queen Street and those places were like in the 80s, unless they were on the new music. But I certainly, when I arrived in the 90s, they were kind of just, you know, just shops full of weird paraphernalia, right? And it was this kind of cultural detritus, which is a recurring thing in Gibson, right? Like in Neuromancer, what he kind of, he's running away from Molly, not knowing she's not out to kill him, flies out a window and he lands in a pile of fiber optic, you know, because it's just, you know, because people are just throwing out more than they're making.
Yeah.
What is it in... Pattern Recognition, which is another great book, there was the original home computer. What was it? The ZX81 by who is it?
Candy?
Timex, wasn't it?
Okay.
It's just like a flat keyboard with a little screen, you know. In Pattern Recognition, they're all about this kind of, you know, cultural garbage being recycled as, you know, as trends and fetishes. And so people are selling this stuff off of a truck and these old, old trashy computers are now like new and shiny again through nostalgia.
That sounds familiar.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Right. Again, a really observant thing. I did want to bring up the Springsteen thing. Should I bring it up now?
Let's do that. Talk a little bit more about the musical influences on Gibson and Neuromancer.
Neuromancer. Here we go. He's like, I don't know what kind of punk shows he went to, but it turns out he's more of a classic rocker than we all would have thought. But yeah, it turns out that, and this is a quote from an interview in the Paris Review. This is actually fun too. I thought cyberspace was exciting, but none of the people I knew who were actually involved in the nascent digital industry were exciting. I wonder what it would be like if they were exciting, stylish, and sexy. That's fun. But anyway. Okay, I found the answer not so much in punk rock as in Bruce Springsteen, in particular, Darkness at the Edge of Town.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
So, like, what if the protagonist of Darkness on the Edge of Town was a computer hacker? And I'm still quoting here. What if he's got Springsteen's character's emotionality and utterly, utterly beat down hopelessness? And I'm like, yeah, right. Now I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I've always felt like in some ways that Springsteen and Joe Strummer were like separated at birth, you know, like and one grew up in England and one grew up in the States, and they're both reacting to the fucking systems that they live in. And they both play Stratocasters and, you know, chop away at chunky chords too. Have you ever seen Springsteen do London Calling?
No, I bet he'd be great.
Yeah,
he's got the voice for it. Yeah.
He did it as part of a tribute after Strummer died. It might have been, I don't know, what, the British Music Awards or something like that. But he, it's online, as everything is, because that's the world we live in. And actually, it was The Clash where I was exposed to dub for the first time, you know, with things from Sandinista. And then I discovered Lee Scratch Perry. But nice touch. Oh, and I guess we should also mention that Screaming Fist comes from a Vile Tones song, which
excellent. Okay.
Yeah, and the Vile Tones were a Toronto punk band. And I can see why he would have been drawn towards punk and dub. I remember hearing him say too that, like, you know, how Neuromancer is so far removed from Star Wars. And he says, well, you know, it's not just that. It's not just that it's whatever, less than a decade later, whatever, 7 years after the fact. Because he said, you know, at the same time Star Wars is happening, the Sex Pistols are also happening. So, right. You know, we live in a world with a lot of things going on and a lot of different ways to respond to the world we live in.
Star Wars kind of, liking Star Wars, but I mean, like, Star Wars, it kind of, the year before was Logan's Run. You know, and like up till then, the 70s were dominated by these kind of dystopian think piece movies like, you know, Marathon Man and
even Rollerball.
Green and what's that? Sorry, which?
Rollerball. We get some sort of almost touches of
the corporation.
Not so. The corporation and also information being put into computers and controlled.
Yeah. Identity.
I would say Rollerball has got a lot of kind of, you know, cyberpunk roots in it. Right, for sure. Yeah,
but sorry, I think I interrupted you there, Stephen.
I can't remember who interrupted you. But no, you're absolutely right. Rollerball is a great, it's exactly indicative of what I was saying, right? So it's true that Star Wars kind of, things went one way from there, but I guess things kept going another way, right? You had Star Wars, but then you had Alien, which kind of brought it all back to that grittiness again, right?
Yeah, Saturn 3 even has them plugging this computer into their back of the neck.
Yeah.
Not the greatest film ever made, but...
But, yeah, it's on the... Neither is Johnny Mnemonic, but I've watched that practically more than any other film, interestingly enough.
I need to go watch that now, because I didn't realize it was had Gibson roots. So I need to go check that out. I also
tried to disown it a bit because he wrote a script for it and then the filmmakers got at it and he's like, I don't know what happened. But anyway.
But, what I want to rewatch as well is Carpenter's Escape from New York, because I didn't realize that had a bit of an influence on Gibson. So
makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
I just watched that recently with a bunch of people, including Dave.
Yep.
And it was, God, that's a fun movie, but yeah, it's, I thought you were dead.
You know? Yeah, Snake Plissken. I heard you were dead. Yes.
Yeah. That's right. That keeps recurring.
But certainly the escape there, like just the setting in Escape from New York felt so much like this sort of Blade Runner and this kind of cyberpunk thing. And the whole idea of a lot of the people in it, like, I don't know why it always in Blade Runner, it's always raining, but you almost feel that that's just, you know, you can't get through life without something falling on your head.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I remember, Dave. I do remember from our Blade Runner show, because in the book, originally it was all sand and Ridley Scott realized there's no way, you know, this is pre-CGI. There's no way we can have sand blowing around our cameras constantly. So he's like, what do we do to replace this whole sand dryness thing? And he went for rain instead.
And then Villeneuve did it in 2049, because there's like a ton of sand in that movie.
Yeah, because now you can do it, right? You're not going to damage lenses and get sand in your mechanisms and whatnot.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where you're going to go with this, but I can answer your next question. But I also just wanted to say that I wanted to say things about Delaney, but Samuel R. Delaney.
Yeah,
sure.
Please. But
I can do it now or do it later.
Yeah, do it now.
Okay. But I was thinking about it because we were talking about influences and the amount of influence. I read there was a lot, and then I was like looking over stuff last night and going, oh crap, yeah, there's more than I thought. I don't know if either you read Nova, that novel.
No.
But in that novel, space pilots, anyone who's a space pilot has like a port in the back of their neck and their wrist. So they can neurologically plug into this into a spaceship to pilot the spaceship. So hello, cyberspace.
Mm-hmm.
And there are characters in I think the moderns, right? The what you call them, the modern that group. They all where they have these kind of cyber punks that have like ports in the back of their necks to plug into the put in. Software on discs and so on. But there's also, if you're, the character, Pierre Riviera, that guy, the psychopath who makes mm-hmm. holograms. In Nova, there's a device called the sensory syrinx, which people jack into and produce holograms as a form of entertainment. And then in another Delaney novel, Dahlgren, there is this street gang called the Scorpions, and they project images of monsters, larger than life monsters, with holograms. Also that there's a warehouse scene where the hero of the novel walks into a warehouse that's like covered in like cables that produce these holograms, right? And it reminded me a lot of kind of Case falling into that pile of cyber optics, which is repeated about three times in the book. But then there's kind of what I'm calling like an Easter egg, where it's like there's a weird thing in Delaney, and I think it's part fetish and it's part I think it's kinky for him, but I think it's also kind of him saying something like maybe like a tarot card or something. But there's like a lot of characters with one bare foot. Like in Nova, space pilots have this fashion of having one bare foot and then the hero of Dahlgren, the kid, his sandaled foot jabbed into the mud, his bare foot swung onto the graveled shoulder. He staggered onto the asphalt, one foot sliding on flooded leather, taking a hissing breath and gazed around, blah, blah, blah. But then in Neuromancer, the head of the, the head of that weird Tessier Ashpool family. He wore a robe of maroon silk quilted around the long cuffs and shawl collar. One foot was bare, the other in a velvet slipper with an embroidered fox head over the instep. Nice little detail from Gibson there.
Mm-hmm.
So, next page, he spat on the carpet near his one bare foot. There it is again. And then again. He remembered the litter of the old man's chamber, the soiled humanity of it, the ragged spines of the old audio discs, one foot bare, the other in a velvet slipper. And then Case, the hero, he doesn't have one bare foot, but you remember like Molly, is like, here, I got this tan stuff so you can fit in. And she covers him in this kind of fake tan, but she runs out of cream. And so one foot is white. And that's brought up like a couple of times that he's got this one white foot as opposed to the one barefoot. So there's this very deliberate sort of, I think, homage to Samuel L. Delaney in that.
That is an interesting thing to pick up on. Isn't it Tarantino who supposedly has a foot fetish?
Oh, yeah.
As well, too, where he always has women showing their feet on camera.
Every film. Yeah. If you're into that, some really sexy foot shots in every film. <It's true. laughs> Anyway. Yeah.
So it's interesting when we talk about the influences. See, this is the first time I've read the book. And so I couldn't believe, you know, the comparisons to The Matrix. And I was like, oh my God, like how did they get away with that? And it absolutely reminded me of Harlan Ellison suing James Cameron for Terminator. Now I know Harlan Ellison is, you know, famously cantankerous and wants his due, but for those who don't know, it was a couple of Outer Limits episodes that he was supposedly Cameron actually fessed up to it, and that's why he said, well shit, if he's gonna say that these are based on Ellison's works and these are the two works, then I'm gonna call him out more, you know, like give me due, like on the film. Yeah. So they did end up, it's now part of the credits, reads acknowledgement to the works of Harlan Ellison. But what do you think, Stephen? I mean, clearly there's a lot of dues to be paid, you would think, on that one.
Well, I think it's, I mean, yeah, Harlan Ellison is famously cantankerous, but I think he also comes from this kind of this old West kind of period where, you know, you sometimes had to like kind of throw an ashtray to get paid, right? So and interestingly, William Gibson, who is much more mild mannered, right? And one of the things that's great about him is he's kind of consistently a fan of things.
Yeah.
You know, like he wrote an Alien script because he loved the Alien movies. He wrote an X-Files script because he loved Alien and the X-Files. And he's like, I can dress Scully like Ripley. And, you know, and he sold the script based on that. But so his reaction to the Matrix movies was, oh, I think they're really good. You know, but yeah, I mean, it's like the Matrix is called the Matrix. I even think I don't know what the Wachowskis did, but I wondered if they watched Johnny Mnemonic and went, oh, let's put Keanu Reeves in this movie called The Matrix. But it felt like it was kind of a sequel to Johnny Mnemonic. And then, yeah, I mean, like, and on the reread of Neuromancer, we were talking about, you know, the Rude Boys there from Zion Cluster, and where do the people who escape the Matrix live? They live in Zion,
right?
So yeah, I mean, like, it's not even subtle, right?
Yeah.
They're just lucky that William Gibson was entertained and didn't come out.
And I do think, going back to sort of your comments about Delaney, he said something to the effect of, well, you know, I had things influence me, and, you know, now it's my turn to influence other people. We have a couple of other things sort of from our asshat department coming up as we push towards an end. Was I the only one who sort of saw the child Neuromancer? Did he remind anyone of Clint Howard's Baylock from Star Trek's The Corbomite Maneuver?
I didn't think of that. I think you're a bit right. But you know what I did think of is what happened to Linda Lee. Hmm. Since this is the ultimate spoiler, Linda Lee, who lives in the Matrix now forever. The last scene, one of the last scenes in the book, there's Linda Lee with a virtual case cuddling with her. And that made me think of The Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Nice. Now, actually, I feel even better about it, thinking of that.
Yeah. Also, I think his final data run, where he finally kind of smashes the big ice, right? I think there's a bit of 2001 in that.
Yeah. Yeah. David, did you want to mention the Jetsons, or?
This was something that Troy thought of earlier. We were setting up the episode, and I thought it was a brilliant idea. What would the Jetsons be like if it were written by William Gibson?
Right. And
it'd be a bit darker, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, and we kind of sort of chatted about this a bit at the beginning, right? And because I saw that question come up on the screen, and I was like, oh, I don't want to answer that. And then I thought about it. And I was like, wait, hang on. So it's like, yeah, no, yeah, yeah. Rosie the robot, you know, yeah, wants to achieve sentience through nefarious means. George Jetson works for a Zaibatsu, like a corrupt Zaibatsu corporation.
Yes.
And I can't bear to think of what poor, you know, what happened to the poor Jetson kids.
Like, yeah. And I just want it, you know, even just art design. I want to see it just darker, You know, obviously there's going to be some controlled substance issues, or not controlled substances, I guess.
Well, that's why I'm scared for the teenager, especially the teenager, but, you know, because I mean, she's hanging out with all these kind of rock bands who are quite safe on the Jetsons, but I just can't imagine what kind of, you know, she's hanging out with, you know, with dark wave musicians who get her into Speed or something. Oh God. You know?
Yeah. I just think it could have a nicely sort of dark Rick and Morty type of edge to it. Well, we're about to wrap up, Stephen, and we would love to give you an opportunity to let listeners know either, you know, what you're up to, where they can find more of you, and anything else you'd like to tell us as you take have the soapbox for a little while.
I did mention that there's kind of the work in progress, Zone Boy and the Worm of Incidents, which Dave's seen a little bit of, and that actually does have like I think it's about 9 installments just as kind of a text product. But I've been working on developing a podcast of that, which will be like a kind of a podcast serial with like 10-minute episodes. But the thing that has happened since working on that is I discovered that I'm a massive fan of electronic music. And actually the next appearance I'll be having is at the Toronto Electronic Music Open Mic. Before the episode is broadcast, so that'll be over. Check out the Toronto Electronic Music Open Mic. It's at Handle Bar in Kensington Market.
Oh, cool.
I love that. I love Handle Bar.
Right. The other thing, I'm actually working on developing another podcast, which will be online sooner. Like, I mean, for Zone Boy, I kind of want to make a series, you know, like a season, and then you can kind of catch them all in one go. I'll be starting to post like very soon, this week, I think maybe the next one, a podcast based on, the Paths of Pollen book, based on interviews I've done, or this one will be like kind of a tour of the Joggins Fossil Cliffs in Nova Scotia. It was supposed to be a short little thing, but it turned into like a documentary. But anyway, threw a bit of electronic music in there too, because I'm like talking about science, and it's like, well, okay, here's something to sweeten the science. And actually, I think there is there's a website which is all things Paths of Pollen, which is Paths of Pollen, one word, .StephenHumphrey, one word, .ca.
And Stephen, for our fans, Stephen is PH.
Right. Zone Boy Worm, one word, .StephenHumphrey, .ca. You can kind of read the 9 installments. It was supposed to just be a flash fiction project. And if you want to hang on one more thing, sorry. I have like one attempt at an audio attempt at the Zone Boy pilot, and also some electronic music, on SoundCloud. And that is actually, you want to go on SoundCloud and search for Zone Boy 1, and that's spelled out. Not a numeral 1, but 0, you know, O-N-E, so Zone Boy 1. So I would direct you to those 3 places for versions of my content.
Good stuff. Thanks very much.
And maybe what I'll present to you is something that has kind of a 80s John Carpenter sort of vibe, that seemed it would kind of fit your wheelhouse. And that one's called Cyborg Walking.
All right. Enjoy, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Stephen. So that's our Neuromancer episode. Thanks to our special guest, Stephen Humphrey. Thank you so much, sir.
Been great to have you.
Yes, this has been super fun.
And long time overdue as well. Folks, please remember to catch us on all of our socials. Go to your favorite podcast provider, but I assume you're there right now. We are available on Spotify. Our website is numeric2of.ca. And on Facebook, we are Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. Please, we love it when you join us there because we can share posts and comment and chat back and forth.
I am David Klink.
And I am Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next episode of Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.